and this is something I'm actually very passionate about, but this whole climate crisis fear-mongering that's going on and is trying to brute force changes across the globe in terms of how economies operate and what they can do with energy and what they can do with financing, ESG being a big theme. That's why I'm excited to speak with you two. We're joined by Ian Davis as well, who is co-writing a series with Whitney that dives into the sustainable development goals set out by the UN and GFANZ and this weird public-private partnership that's been brewing in the background for some time now. So I guess I'll just throw it to you, Whitney. Why are you guys writing this piece, and what do you think are the most important topics we'll cover today?
Cool. So, so basically the series that Ian and I are doing is called Sustainable Slavery. The first piece is out, and it's called Sustainable Debt Slavery. And it's sort of an introduction to the idea of how SDGs, or the Sustainable Development Goals, also basically the same thing, more or less, as Agenda 2030, are intended to operate in the sense of how they're going to be enacted, or rather imposed, on nation states. So this series sort of started because I found Ian is like my favorite person to talk about public-private partnerships with, because I think he has a handle on it that is like really easy to understand for people that, you know, don't work in this world necessarily, and help explain it to a lay person. And so I stumbled across this thing, I'll just call it that. It's basically the UN-backed mechanism to back SDG number 3, which deals with healthcare. It's called UHC 2030. And it is, of course, it's a public-private partnership between the worst actors in big pharma and, you know, major governments like the UK and Canada. I think the US is on board as well. And, you know, many, many other countries, and it's the means of implementing this particular SDG. So I had Ian take a look at it. And at the same time, I was working on a piece aimed at another SDG that deals with ocean conservation. It's really a land grab and debt for land swaps and stuff. So, you know, it just seemed pretty obvious, like, why don't we just do an introductory piece and go hard on pretty much every SDG and dismantle it, because it's all bullshit, at least what they're selling it as.
Well, you know? I'm happy you brought up the land grab for the ocean territory, because that was actually one of the top comments in our last episode. I think you mentioned it the last time I recorded last month, yeah. And somebody was like, we need to dive further into that. So hopefully we can do that today. But what I think was interesting, something that really stuck out to me in your piece, is that a major driver behind these sustainable development goals is the climate crisis. And you guys highlight that only one of the SDGs, SDG 13, I believe, has anything to do with climate.
Yeah. Yeah, nominally. I mean, I think they cloak a lot of the other stuff. They like to bring up climate change a lot, but, you know, in terms of, there's only one SDG that deals expressly with climate action. And the rest of them are all about other things. And, you know, the UN here is using sustainable as a synonym for transformative or transformation. And it's not the same thing. Obviously, at least that's how, you know, sustainable is being used because of how most people in the public conceive of the idea of sustainable. And obviously, sustainable is preferable to unsustainable, right? And so that's part of why, you know, they're using that particular word, but what they mean is transformative. And they give that away a lot. You know, one of the graphics that is used in the piece is from the UN and is about the SDGs, and it says, you know, transformation, and that, you know, it's all about transforming everything. And, you know, as Ian pointed out in the part he wrote in the piece, there's an SDG for literally every part of your life. And Ian, if you want to comment on that, I'll throw it to you.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Agenda 2030, you know, the it states there that the basis of it is what it's all about is about transformation. That is what they're seeking. And as Whitney says, there are 17 SDGs, only one of which is specifically about climate. And, you know, there isn't really any aspect of our lives which there isn't an SDG for, which the purpose of that is to transform that aspect of our lives. And that includes the most personal, you know, there's sexual health in there as well, that There's an SDG to transform that and to transform, you know, family planning and so forth. So, I mean, there isn't really any aspect that there isn't an intention, and I think this is the key thing, at a global governance level to change our lives. And certainly with if we look at, I think it's SDG 17, which is about, which talks about the partnerships for how we are going to be taken through this transition process, it's very clearly based upon what they're calling multi-stakeholder partnerships. But what that actually boils down to is private sector, multinational corporations, effectively leading this policy agenda, because governments are kind of relegated to the role of what they call creating the enabling environment, which means setting up the policy framework and also investment that will enable the SDGs to be rolled out or to be achieved. And you know, and as Whitney was saying, is this, that this means a transformation of nearly every aspect of our lives.
Yeah, and one thing you guys highlight in your piece is that the IMF, which has historically been viewed as the supranational banking entity that is sort of separate from the private sector, is going to begin merging with some of the biggest banks in the world. JP Morgan, HSBC, Bank of America, I believe, are who you singled out specifically in your piece. And so this is part of that public-private partnership that is beginning to spread. And I think this is an interesting time to jump into that particular relationship between the IMF and the private banks, because that's something I've written about in my newsletter and talked a lot about on this podcast throughout the years, is the IMF, by any objective measure, is terrible for countries that interact with it. I wrote a newsletter, I believe, in June of this year, when Argentina went and took out another loan from the IMF. Argentina, since 1944, has had an annual inflation rate, since 1944, almost 100 years, 80 years almost, of 200%, 191% annually for the last 78 years. In 1956, they started interacting with the IMF, and since then, they've taken out 21 loans. And so you think if the IMF is actually going to be helping these countries, Argentina specifically in this case, they would be on stable footing. They wouldn't have 191% annual inflation if the IMF is actually here to help. And so I think it is weird that we're setting these sustainable development goals and we're trusting the IMF, and now the IMF in partnership with some of the biggest banks who have wrought some of the worst financial crimes and misallocation of capital in our society over the last few decades, and we're essentially handing over trust to them to fix the world and transform the world.
Right. So you brought up two separate things there, because I would comment on Argentina a little bit separately, because that's a whole can of worms. I investigated at one point when I was doing a series for Mint Press News, and I didn't unfortunately get to publish all my research on it. But it's my opinion that the economic collapse in Argentina in 2001 was engineered by the governments it had during the 1990s. And one of the goals of that was to intentionally force them to take out loans from institutions like the IMF, because the goal was a debt for land swap. Going way, way back, before Argentina's economic collapse, even, there was an effort to sort of get, for bankers wanted Patagonia for some reason. And so there was this big effort for this debt for land swap. And even in the most, past couple of years now, in name of the SDGs, actually the current president of Argentina, in talking to the IMF about debt restructuring, talked about the idea of doing a debt for conservation swap, which, as I mentioned a little bit ago, is basically the repackaged SDG version of the debt for land swap of yesteryear. It's a land grab, but it's being justified as, you know, oh, this is for conservation, for climate, whatever. But ultimately, you know, the way they're setting things up, something that could happen, you know, okay, they're setting apart this area for conservation, but it's going to be managed by a natural asset corporation. And that natural asset corporation, you know, can develop it ostensibly to conserve, but okay, oh, there's minerals found in it. Okay, they're going to set up a mining operation, and that's not conserving, but they can offset that by buying financial products that allow them to trade whatever in carbon markets and offset the environmental damage they're doing by, you know, moving those credits to somewhere else where they like plant a forest in a country on the other side of the world and all this gobbledygook. I mean, that's basically the system they're setting it up. So the IMF for a long time has been seen, like you said, as supranational, but a lot of people have sort of pegged it as being dominated by the U.S. empire in this unipolar model following World War II. And actually, there's this army manual that was leaked by WikiLeaks. It's from 2008. And they refer to the IMF as being a financial weapon. And they talk about it, also refer to it as being part of the global system of financial governance. So it's considered a weapon of unconventional warfare and part of this global financial system. And now, and we saw this in a big way with COP26 last year, you have Larry Fink, for example, of BlackRock coming out and saying, we need, if we want to get serious about climate change, we need to reimagine the World Bank and the IMF. And that's also when you have GFANZ, which you mentioned earlier, the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, which is basically Mark Carney and Mike Bloomberg coming together for financial hell upon Earth. You know, I don't know any other way to describe it. They're basically saying, let's merge the IMF and, you know, in the World Bank, let's reimagine them, like Larry Fink says, by merging them with private banks and making it all one big happy family. So that means essentially instead of becoming unconventional weapons for, you know, U.S. empire or the Anglo-American empire, whoever you want to think of it, it's now the financial weapon of the banksters that are basically behind the whole climate change, sustainable development agenda.
And this multipolar world that we're going to transition to.
I'll let Ian talk about multipolarity. He has some great articles on that, so...
Yeah, I'm not convinced by the multipolar new world order. I think it's kind of an extension. I think it's the natural transition, actually, of the unipolar world order. It's where it's got to go in order to make this global transition to a new economic and new international monetary and financial system in order to enable that. And it's something that the think tanks and the oligarchs have been talking about for a long time. There needs to be a transition of power from west to east, because that's where the new emerging markets are, which is something that in GFANZ, if you look at what GFANZ is made of, this Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, a big, you know, it's made up of these different alliances. They call them alliances. Well, if you look at the alliance for, I think it's called the Banking Alliance. I can't remember the exact title of it, but if you look at that particular alliance, the people in that are HSBC, Deutsche Bank, JP Morgan. These kind of banks are in there, and one of the goals of that is to set policy, so to inform policy through the GFANZ forum. So when we consider that Deutsche Bank last year, or maybe it was the year before, said that we really need to consider about what level of dictatorship we will accept in order to move towards sustainable development. If we're, as Whitney was saying, this common thing comes up that if we're serious about it, then we really need to consider things like dictatorship, which Deutsche Bank were openly discussing. They are now informing policy through things like GFANZ at a global level. And that is what is going to be feeding into sustainable development. And I think one of the things that strikes me about it, and when we talk about the concept of sustainable development, which most people probably believe, is that it doesn't really matter whether or not you think that sustainable development aims at somehow mitigating the impacts of climate change. Even if you accept that climate change, as it's described to us by the quote unquote science, is genuine, and that, you know, that we are heading towards some sort of climate catastrophe, even if you accept that, sustainable development is not the solution to it. sustainable development has got nothing to do really with addressing the problems that that are said to cause this impending climate disaster. For example, you know, carbon trading and carbon offsetting doesn't mean reducing the amount of CO2 that's been put into the being put into the atmosphere.
They admit that in their own stuff, basically. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that. What it means is that the quote unquote big polluters can carry on polluting to their heart's content as long as they offset it some way through what is already projected to be a $120 trillion carbon trading market.
Which the banks love.
Which, so of course.
Obviously, it's a new casino, dude.
It is the new casino. And if you're Deutsche Bank, who are then part through GFANs, are then, you know, at contributing towards the policies at a government level, and then and that's when we get down to the national government level, who are setting the policy environments or the quote-unquote enabling environment to enable this to happen, then of course, if you're a global financial institution like Deutsche Bank, or I'm not picking on them particularly, but any of them, that is a really enticing prospect. So that's really the nature of so-called sustainable development.
Ultimate regulatory capture.
Well, yeah, the other side of it is turning everything into a commodity, including things that aren't currently part of the economic system. So that's things like financializing what they call natural capital or the financial world, also human capital and social capital. And they've even been pitching, I think, in outlets like New York Magazine, I think it was, like basically selling stock in yourself and like in your future and like how much money you'll make after a time, and like people can buy stock in your life. I mean, it's getting that
your favorite blockchain wants to do this. Ethereum wants people to be able to sell personal equity in themselves.
Favorite blockchain. Yeah.
No, but it's
no comment.
Well, I have a couple of things I want to say. Number one, just the people involved. That's what I really want to get through to anybody listening to this, and hopefully you guys share this because I think it's important. There is a mass. I mean, the power that these people have already grabbed is incalculable.
Insane.
And they're going for more and more, and it's just like you, Mark Carney. We mentioned him, HSBC, Deutsche Bank. Mark Carney and HSBC specifically. When Mark Carney was, I forget if he was the head of the ECB, or not the ECB, the Bank of England, or he was part of the Canadian Central Bank.
He was head of Canada's and England's Central Bank.
Yes, he's been head of both, but when HSBC had their Mexican drug cartel crisis where they got caught laundering money for the Zeta cartel, the U.S. Treasury tried to essentially shut down HSBC, but Mark Carney stepped in on behalf of HSBC and basically said, hey, just slap him on the wrist with a fine. So there's some terrible moral hazard just with Mark Carney specifically being a public sector banker at the Bank of England or the Central Bank of Canada.
Yeah, but he's the guy that UN put in charge of all this shit.
Right? Well, yeah. So this is what I want to highlight. Like, these are the people running all this stuff. And then Deutsche Bank, Whitney, as we've talked about in past episodes, I mean, they were openly allowing Jeffrey Epstein to use their bank to wire hundreds of thousands of dollars after he had been imprisoned and let free. Now they're trying to work together.
Now they have an ocean resilience philanthropy fund they're big in the ocean conservation market now, and it's a market. They're calling it the blue economy. And Deutsche Bank is trying to be at the center of it. It's so dumb. I mean, you read the stuff that they're promoting, the groups involved in this, including Deutsche Bank's philanthropic arm. Oh, sorry, did I cut out?
You're good.
Yeah, like Deutsche Bank's philanthropic arm, they're like they'll say stuff. It's business as usual, but they just put blue in front of like the word loan or any other financial product. And all of a sudden it's part of the blue economy and it's really good and it's sustainable development. And it's great for the environment. Blue loan, blue bonds, you know, blue investing. It's all great now.
Well,
because
green
we put
flag,
primary
right?
color in front of it.
Yeah. Well, so I mean, this goes back to like what you were getting at with the word sustainable. It has this connotation that people just take for granted. Like, oh, sustainable.
Exactly.
That's good. We should be going towards it. Blue. It's a good color. Green. That's a good color. It's not red. It's not orange. It's not black. So yeah, we should definitely
go
forward with
this. That's the level
this.
Of mentality though that they expect from us, right? They don't expect us to actually think about all this stuff. And they admit so much in like their own documents about it. But they think they can just get people because they view most of us as like kindergartners mentally. Yeah. Like basically subhuman on some level. And, you know, they've gotten away with so much over the decades. They're like, well, we'll just, it's not going to be a hard sell because they're not going to think about it or really look into this stuff.
Well, so
and, you know, I've pretty much been right so far.
I do have to wonder when it's interesting that you should say that because when you read through a lot of this documentation, when you read through a lot of this stuff, I do think, because it's just junk, isn't it? I mean, a lot of it, you read it and you think, well, how could anybody ever think that that was a good idea? And I think you're right. I think it's predicated upon their perception that no one's going to read it. The only people that are going to read it are people that are, you know, obsessive about it, perhaps like people like us, and you know, each other as a kind of signal that this is the roadmap that we are going to use. You know, that's they're relying on the fact that, well, with good reason, they can rely on the fact that the mainstream media aren't going to report it. I mean, that's so they can know that that's not going to happen. So they can just put any junk in these statements and think they can get away with it. And I just wanted to add something while we were talking about the multipolar world order, where we're heading with the multipolar world order. I've recently been doing a bit of research on that transition. And I just wanted to, I'm talking about Mark Carney, who is also a trustee of the World Economic Forum. He's the UN Special Envoy for Climate Change. And he was also a board member of the Financial Standards Board. And I mean, it just goes on and on and on with Carney. He's in absolutely everything. Yep. But this is what he said. And I couldn't believe this because I reread this talking about the multipolar world order. This is what he said at Jackson Hole in 2019. So he's talking about this this is a quote from his statement, a destabilizing asymmetry at the heart of the IMFS, International Monetary and Financial System, is growing. While the world economy is being reordered, the US dollar remains as important as when Bretton Woods collapsed. In the medium term, policymakers need to reshuffle the deck. That is, we need to improve the structure of the current IMFS. In the longer term, we need to change the game. Any unipolar system is unsuited to a multipolar world. In the new world order, a reliance on keeping one's house in order is no longer sufficient. The neighbourhood too must change. A multipolar global economy requires a new IMFS to realise its full potential. That won't be easy. Transition between global reserve currencies are rare events. It's an open question whether a new synthetic hegemonic currency would be best provided by the public sector, perhaps through a network of central bank digital currencies. A synthetic hegemonic currency might smooth the transition that the IMFS needs. The deficiencies of the IMFS have become increasingly potent. Even a passing acquaintance with monetary history suggests the centre won't hold. Let's end the malign neglect of the IMFS and build a system worthy of the diverse, multipolar global economy that's emerging. So when people talk about this new multipolar global economy and world order that we are heading into, it has been planned over the last 20, 30 years as the destination. This is where we are heading to. So the idea as well that it presents some kind of some kind of bulwark against globalist ambitions is just, and China and Russia are fully on board, of course, with sustainable development.
Well, actually, they said that just recently, Putin and Xi are meeting, I forget in which country, on the sidelines of some conference, I guess. And I saw earlier today, you know, clips from their respective speeches, and they're saying, we want to build a, you know, unipolar world is increasingly dangerous. We want a multipolar model that's just and fair. And they emphasize the role, the central role of the UN in that. And everything we're talking about right now is coming from the UN. Yeah. And then, you know, they bring up sustainable development multiple times. So, you know, they are totally on board with this stuff. And they had a joint statement a few months ago that you wrote about, Ian, where they basically said it back then, but they're still saying it. And that's why I think this, you know, it's so important to go into what the UN is doing, because so many people conceive of the UN as, oh, it's just a meeting of all the different public sectors of the world. You know, and they don't realize the influence of the bankers, the multinational corporations, and all of that at the UN. I mean, maybe some people do now in the COVID era, because it became common knowledge, the role of Bill Gates, for example, in financing the World Health Organization, right? But, you know, the UN does not operate the way a lot of people conceive of it as. And so them talking about the UN being the center, you know, all of this crap we're talking about, Russia and China are on board with it, because if we know this stuff, they know this stuff, plain and simple.
And this whole war going on right now can just be a big distraction too.
Well, I think it's, you know, with Ukraine, you're just seeing a big reallocation of capital and weapons. Basically what's, you know, all these weapons are going to Ukraine, but only 30% are actually going to Ukrainian soldiers fighting on the front lines. Where is the 70% going? And why is no one trying to find that out? And the same thing with the money. How many billions has the Biden administration pumped into Ukraine? And we have to pump more and more and more. I mean, and you have the German foreign minister basically saying, you have to like freeze your butt off this winter because I want to deliver for the Ukrainian people. And I don't give a flying F what the German voters think. You know, that's extreme. Europe is literally shooting itself on the foot on purpose. And this is, in my opinion, a pre-planned reallocation of wealth somewhere else. And Ukraine is just the laundering point for all of it. You're having arms trafficking go on and money laundering going on. And the question is, where is that money and where are those weapons going? And not a lot of people are really interested in finding out the answer, but it very much could be related to this reallocation of power that we're talking about, this whole shift to a multipolar world. The unipolar world is concentrated, or has been concentrated, in the West, and they're doing a controlled demolition of the Western economy right now. And the standard of living. Why is that happening?
Yeah.
And they're doing it on purpose, because they know the sanctions aren't hurting Russia. I mean, it's obvious. It's been obvious, and they haven't changed. So why not?
Yeah. I mean, it just came out this morning that one of their largest oil producers has had the most profitable quarter it's had in decades. And Europe shooting itself in the foot. It's another focus of this show is the energy policy that's been enacted by the West. Where, like, why would you spin down completely clean and carbon neutral nuclear power plants in favor of unreliable sources and then become wholly dependent on Russian natural gas as well. But I think we should dive into the UN. And I think before we dive into what they're actually doing, we should go back to how it started, because that's one thing I mentioned to you both before we started recording, which you highlight in your first piece in the series, is that the UN, like you mentioned, everybody views it as some public partnership of the governments around the world that was just started out of the goodness of their hearts, but there's actually private entities that helped get it off the ground, particularly the Rockefeller Foundation. That's something I was completely unaware of before reading your piece.
You want to take that one, Ian, or I can do it if you want?
I mean, the Rockefeller Foundation were... actually, the two interesting things, the Rockefeller Foundation have been deeply involved from the pre-war period, going back, you know, before the Second World War, are particularly involved in the development of what we might call global governance through what was then the League of Nations, but also very heavily involved in China. So the Rockefellers have been instrumental in building up the Chinese economy as well. But that's a kind of a side issue. but it's a notable parallel. But the but with the League of Nations, that I think that there was a perception after the Second World War that the League of Nations had failed, and the Rockefellers were particularly involved with the, I can't remember the name of the, do you remember, Whitney, what were they called, the I can't remember the name of the UN body that the the League of Nations body, but it was something to do with global government development.
I'm not familiar.
But that was the transition. That was kind of the transition point at which the League of Nations was changed into the what is now, you know, the United Nations. And the Rockefellers not only funded that department entirely, they were the money. There wasn't any government money in funding that department, that basically more or less became the UN Secretariat, as the Secretariat is now. That was entirely Rockefeller funded. So now it is funded by the contribution of member states, but it wouldn't have been put in place had the Rockefellers not been pushing it.
Well, I was just going to add that the Rockefeller family also donated the money to purchase the land in New York City, in which the UN headquarters sits in New York. And that's the only reason the UN headquarters is in New York, is because of the role of the Rockefeller family there. So they have a lot of influence, and they've been involved in global governance and pushing for global governance, and specifically the global preeminence of public-private partnerships since the 40s, if not earlier. And so you see a lot of influence there. And this is a family also that historically has funded things like eugenics. They're very interested in setting policy, particularly in the developing world, because they want less people in the developing world. And, you know, there's a lot of things going on when you're talking about the Rockefellers, but someone like David Rockefeller, for example, in his memoirs published in the early 2000s, basically admits that his whole family has been pushing for a global governance system for a long time. And people confuse sometimes the idea of one world government, global government, with global governance. And Ian has a really good way of explaining that, the difference and why it matters.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that governance is more about policy agendas rather than setting specific hard and fast policies. So you create the policy agenda generally through the global financial institutions working in tandem with the international think tanks. So they create a broad policy trajectory of where we want the end goal for policy. Where do we want this to lead? And then that can be then disseminated through organizations like the IMF and through the World Bank and so forth. That can then be disseminated to national governments. And it's at the national government level at which those policy agenda. So we're not talking about, you know, saying you will do this and you will do that, but rather setting a framework for policy development. And then policy development at the national level is, that's when it gets through, obviously, through legislation and through policy commitments. That's when it becomes hard and fast policy that affects us.
Yeah.
So that's government. So government is obviously the hard rules that we are subject to. But they just set a globalist agenda, which is why you get things like, for example, everybody saying at the same time, build back better, because build back better comes from a document called the Sinai. It was a global policy agenda document called the Sinai Preparedness for Disasters. I can't remember the full title, but it's in that. And that was written in 2015 that we first see them using this term, build back better. So that is a UN consultative document through UN debt, the UN, through UN consultation. They use that term, and then suddenly that gets picked up everywhere by every politician and every leader, because that is part of the agenda, governance agenda, rather than being a specific policy that gets interpreted in different ways in different countries.
Yeah, so from an American perspective, you have Agenda 2030, which is trying to get us to net zero carbon emissions. That's the agenda. And then recently here, we had the Inflation Reduction Act, which is the Green New Deal sort of Trojan horsed through that piece of legislation where people were like, yes, sign the Inflation Reduction Act. We're tired of high prices, but it's really just a Green New Deal marketed as an Inflation Reduction Act. So you have the agenda set, and then the government here in the United States passes the Inflation Reduction Act following that agenda.
Exactly. Yeah, but in the U.S., they disguise it as something else because they don't want to say what they're actually doing. So like you pointed out, it's basically climate policy masquerading as inflation reduction. One of the things that Bill did, for example, was create a national green bank. And I forget the name, but it's another lending mechanism that's supposed to be one of the biggest public-private lending mechanisms for quote-unquote green energy in the world. And it's going to expressly benefit one of the main lobbyists of the Inflation Reduction Act, Bill Gates, who actually is taking credit for getting that bill passed. Bill Gates created something a couple years ago, and his partners in it are people like Jeff Bezos and BlackRock. It's called Breakthrough Energy Catalyst, or BEC. And they basically stand to get most of the money from the National Green Bank in this lending program.
Lovely.
So, yeah, no, but really, it's no joke. And the whole idea here is, you know, a lot of people on the left, for example, like support this policy. They think, oh yeah, solar panels, whatever. This isn't going to be a kind of world where you're allowed to have a solar panel on your roof and power your own house with renewables. This is where they're going to make like power plants of renewables, but the owners are going to be Jeff Bezos, BlackRock, and Bill Gates. And it's going to be, you know, rationing energy usage based on, you know, your how much carbon or whatever else you're consuming in your lifestyle and stuff like that is how that system's set up. But it's centralization of energy. So, okay, it's quote unquote renewables, but you're not going to, it's not decentralized. It's going to be complete centralization of energy. And, you know, energy and food are basically what power civilization. Yeah. So if you control the energy, which Breakthrough Energy Catalyst is now going to do by using our own taxpayer funded money against us, thanks to the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, they're going to take control of energy through by having all that money funneled to them through these mechanisms that were passed in that bill. And then you have at the same time, the same people like Bill Gates buying up all the farmland in the U.S. So they're going to control the food too.
Yeah. And then BlackRock owns all the houses too. So
and they own all the houses. And we're going to become a nation of renters, says Bloomberg. By the way, Bloomberg, you know, Mike Bloomberg, you know, co-founder of GFans with Mark Carney. It's the same very small club. I mean, it's even smaller than the 1% that we were all complaining about in 2008. This is like the 0.001% playing for keeps and taking it all.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we're dealing with right now. And it's totally mental. Because they're getting away with it. And there's people on the left that are like cheering on stuff like the Sunrise Movement that are like, they're not even saying implement these specific policies, Nancy Pelosi. They're like protesting and just take action now, any action. I mean, that's Greta Thunberg's whole thing too, basically. You know, and, you know, we don't have time to think about how we solve it. We just had to do something or there's going to be this climate disaster and we're all doomed. So implement something fast. And here are these ready-made solutions. And oh, look, it's the bankers that have made it all and all these people and, you know, oligarchs. And it's going to create, you know, this crazy system where no one has control over their own lives. And pretty much everything important is owned by an extremely small number of people. And they're only getting away with it because people are not looking into what's being offered to us at all.
Well, they're not looking into it, and then they're leveraging fear with the climate crisis. People are afraid. Yeah. They're like, do something. And actually, it's a bit of a tangent, but I finally realized the contradiction with Bill Gates, particularly. He wants the world to transition to renewables, particularly solar and wind. But focusing on solar, Bill Gates is also the same person who earlier
wants
this
to
year,
blot out the sun.
Exactly. Right? Earlier this year, he was trying to blot out the sun. And he also wants to transition to solar. It's like, how do those two things compute? It doesn't make any sense. So like that small contradiction there, or large contradiction, highlights to me that this really isn't about a sustainable future. It's more about control. And like you said, energy and food are at the lowest substrate of Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
And what crises do you have now in the West? Food
energy.
Yeah. And who's going to build back better when people are demanding for solutions to the crisis that's to come in the coming months?
Yeah.
It's already there. They've already set it up. And in the U.S., the Inflation Reduction Act was the big step towards that. And like, no one covered that story that I've really seen.
No.
Oh, am I back?
No, you're back. You're back. But yeah, no, the Inflation Reduction Act, it's, I mean, pure Orwellian doublespeak, because it's everything in that bill is just going to exacerbate inflation. They're trying to, like, in the act, they're trying to instill price controls. It's like price controls never work economically. They just cause prices to go up.
Yeah. So it's like this stuff with the SDGs. All the stuff, all the existing economic woes of today are fine, according to the UN, and debt, economic crises, all of that can be included under sustainable development, because if we don't implement the SDGs, they promise us that the economic crises that await us are infinitely, infinitely worse, and the debt that await us are infinitely worse than the debt that will be part of sustainable development.
Yeah. That's one thing I think, again, we need to get through to the audience, the broader populace at large, is that these policies are going to kill more people than they pretend to save. And
yeah, and it's debt slavery, and that's why the title of the article is as such, because they admit debt is a critical form of financing for the SDGs. They are going to drown countries in debt. And then use the IMF and the World Bank and all of that stuff to be like, oh, having problems with your debt, I see. Well, impose these specific policies that are all, you know, SDG related and designed by bankers. One other thing I should say about the SDGs is that they all have like these phrases attached to them that all sound really nice and utopic. You know, like everyone can get behind ocean conservation and free healthcare for all and no poverty and no hunger. Yay. But the UN has specific sanctioned programs already in place under all of those SDGs that are already setting up the policy and the infrastructure to implement said SDGs. And that stuff is what we're talking about here. Right. And a lot of it is not actually going to produce what the phrase of the SDG says it's going to produce. That phrase is the justification for the entity hiding behind that SDG. So in the case of like SDG 3 for like healthcare, you know, that's UHC 2030. And that's what's hiding behind that SDG. And the idea of, oh yeah, free health, you know, available healthcare for everyone sounds nice. And we can all, you know, everyone should have healthcare. Yeah. Okay. But you know, accepting that keeps people from scrutinizing what's hiding behind that. And that's how the SDGs are essentially operating. There's all these pre-planned and pre-designed entities hiding behind these utopic phrases of the SDGs that are something else entirely. In every single case. And SDG 17, which is basically the focus of this piece, is partnership for the goals. But in researching this, I found an old graphic that they were using, and apparently the name of it used to be strengthening the implementation of the goals. Right? So that basically is like, yes, a yoke of debt around your neck. And that is how we will strengthen our implementation of these unattractive policies at the end of the day.
Well,
and it's debt. It's debt slavery.
Oh, yes. And mm-hmm. What's even more evil about all of this is, again, going back to, they like to play the fields and use positive connotation and positive messaging. And they're attacking the developing world too. They say, "Hey, we're going to help uplift the global South
framing.
Out of poverty." And so, let's dive into their plans to use debt to just land grab in these third world countries that are trying to pull themselves up from the bootstraps.
Yeah, sure. So I'll actually bring up. The one that I mentioned earlier. So the Nature Conservancy, you may know of this because the head of the Nature Conservancy right now is Henry Paulson, formerly of Goldman Sachs.
The ATMs are going to be out of money by Wednesday. Print $1 trillion.
And we'll declare martial law unless you bail out the banks, Congress. That's Henry Paulson. So Henry Paulson is in charge of the Nature Conservancy. They've launched a new arm called Nature Vest, which is all about investing in natural capital. So in November of last year, NatureVest embarked on its pilot program. And the title of their press release is, "The Government of Belize Partners with the Nature Conservancy to Conserve 30% of its Ocean Through Debt Conversion." Already sounding nice, isn't it? They say, "Innovative project is part of a groundbreaking groundbreaking global plan to fund ocean conservation while providing fiscal and economic benefits for coastal nations. Right. So this is the pilot program. It's going to go global.
They're going to throw a bunch of money in the ocean and call conservation.
No, it's actually worse than you think. So I don't know if you have show notes, but I'm happy to send these links to you so people can see.
Yeah, we'll put everything on the show notes.
So this global program, the Nature Conservancy calls it Blue Bonds for Ocean Conservation. And they describe it as an ambitious plan to drastically scale up durable ocean conservation around the world. This is quoting them. This conservation model is an innovative strategy to work with governments to restructure a portion of their sovereign debt, securing long-term sustainable financing for the management of valuable natural resources. And basically what happened here, if I can pull up their case study, they made a little PDF of it. This is from their transaction highlight section. So basically what happened, per them, Belize repurchased 100% of its super bond to refinance its debt at a 45% discount. A Nature Conservancy subsidiary provided the blue loan to finance the repurchase. DFC, which is the United States International Development Finance Corporation, provided political risk insurance wrap on the blue loan. Credit Suisse financed the blue bonds, which funded the National Conservancy subsidiary to make the blue loan. Yeah, Belize committed to achieving marine conservation targets and using a portion of the financing savings to fund conservation over 20 years, part of which is prohibiting local people from fishing in their own waters.
Lovely.
Wow.
Yeah.
So
this is just the start.
You get debt restructuring fees, you get underwriting fees, and then you cut people off from food sources.
Yeah, so I'm writing a piece specifically on the ocean stuff, and this is crazy, but this is just one part of it. There's a whole organization that's basically mostly bankrolled by Deutsche Bank, the UK government, and the Canadian government. And their whole thing is 50 unique financial products to conserve and protect the world's oceans. And it's just a crazy casino while also being a crazy machine for land grabs in the developing world. And a lot of these pilot programs are expressly in Latin America. And there's a reason for that. And they're probably going to be in Africa too. And the same people behind a lot of the stuff we've been talking about, these oligarchs, a lot of them Silicon Valley oligarchs, they're very interested in mining right now and securing mineral resources for the coming so-called electrical vehicle revolution, and really more broadly, the smart city construction, which requires all of these insane batteries, lithium and cobalt. If you look at a startup that's pretty much all the Silicon Valley guys together, Gates, Bezos, Zuckerberg, Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn, and several others, they have this thing called Cobalt Metals, and you go on their website, they're like, we have to find every reserve for lithium and cobalt in the entire world and secure it, because otherwise we cannot bring, you know, the EV revolution, electric vehicle revolution to fruition. That means all of the Andes, all the way down, including national parks. There's a huge cobalt reserve in a national park down from where I am in Chile in the Andes. And this is supposed to be national park territory here. They're already creeping and mining into it. They illegally drained a lake by my house to start strip mining the side of the lake in the mountains. And there's literally a national park less than a mile away. And a ton of people live there. There's a tourism agency around that lake. They just stole all the water. Nothing's happened to them. And this is going to keep happening all over Latin America because the mining here is so predatory and so insane. It's just madness. And it's going to be the same for Central America too, because they have mountains. I mean, this is a resource grab that is literally going to destroy the developing world like we've never seen before. And that's why they are cloaking this with environmentalism, because if people actually knew what they were going to do to the environment, there's no way they could sell this. And they are getting the countries on board. These are with governments like Costa Rica, Belize, you know, they're getting the governments on board and they're selling it to the people as we're going to lift you out of poverty. And they're selling it as a left-wing project. A lot of these countries have had U.S.-backed right-wing leaders for a long time that have been, you know, in the case of like Colombia, for example, involved in narco trafficking and like other stuff, or, you know, allowing multinational corporations to pillage local people's wealth and stuff. And so they're selling it as a left-wing thing where, you know, we're going to do what Evo Morales did in Bolivia. We're going to pull you out of poverty, but they're not going to do anything like that. It's just a selling point. And they're going to just take it all. And that's what they're doing here. Mm-hmm. So these debt for land swaps have a long history, but they've cloaked them now as debt for conservation swaps and debt for climate swaps. And this has been going on in a huge way. Ian and I were talking about the other day how 15, I think it's all actually, of the UK's national parks are now part of a public-private partnership. No one in the UK voted on this. It just happened last year. Yeah. And that's basically a land grab too. So yeah, your national parks in the UK aren't public anymore. It's a public-private partnership that's financed by Santander Bank and Estee Lauder, the Lauder family.
Yeah.
I mean, that's mental. And there's no coverage of this crap. And no one on the left is talking about it. They're asleep at the wheel or claiming to be environmentalists, and they're enabling literally the worst destruction of the environment ever and the worst pillaging of the developing world that's ever happened. And it sucks for me too, because I live in South America and this is literally happening in my neighborhood. And I think a key part of this agenda too is that they want to depopulate here. So because people would protest the mining and, you know, all this stuff comes together. I think there's a reason why Latin America, you saw, I think more than any other continent in the world, mandatory vaccination policies. You know, you had Ecuador and several other countries like literally make it mandatory to get the COVID vaccine and stuff. But anyway, that's like a separate issue, obviously. But you know, I think it goes hand in hand, to be honest. And there's a lot of really dark stuff that's to come if people don't wake up to this agenda.
Yeah. Ian, did you want to jump in and say something?
Well, really just to support what Whitney said, because the ambition of this is staggering. It is staggering. Mm-hmm. They are talking about basically financializing the earth and everything on it. I mean, I looked at something called the theft of the global commons. So the idea is that the things like the global commons, which are, you know, that you see that mentioned specifically in Agenda 21, but also in lots of documents about conservation and the earth and nature. Broadly defined, the global commons are those things on earth that no one specifically owns at the moment. For example, the Andes. Now some people own parts of the Andes, but no one owns the Andes, right? Well, they're talking about financializing, for example, the Andes. So making that what they're calling a natural asset. So, what does that create? It creates water sources. It creates, you know, it has an environmental impact in and of itself. So that will become a service. That will become a natural service for which can then be licensed, and you can buy and sell the license for that natural service. So if you're going to do something like an open strip mine on the side of a mountain, obviously, that's going to have an impact on conversation, on conservation. So that's going to have an impact on sustainable development. But that's okay, because you can still do it if you can negotiate the license with whoever might be funding that. So you negotiate the license, carry on strip mining anyway, but offset your sustainable. So you can actually, I mean, as has already happened in China, there are a number of coal-fired power stations that have been built in China, which, because they were using less harmful coal-burning technology, were paid for with UN Sustainable Development Grants. So these are brown coal-fired power stations paid for under the auspices of sustainable development. So that gives you some idea of what this is really about. And it has got absolutely nothing to do with protecting the environment. It's got nothing to do with conservation. It's nothing to do with nature. The idea is to sell nature as a service which can be licensed. That is what this is about.
And one thing I want to add to that. So, Ian, you brought up how this is also about financializing the processes of nature. So it's not just mountains, rivers, lakes, whatever, right? Literally the ecological processes that underpin all life are going up on the market. And this includes stuff that, like, you know, you put your body in the ground when you die. That's going to be, you're going to be charged for that now, you know, in this world they're making. The ecological process of decay or anything else, the ecological process by which water is purified by the earth or any of that. I mean, this is all, you're going to be charged, and it's all going to be part of this new crazy economic system. And who do you think that benefits? I mean, they're framing this as like pulling out of poverty the third world. I mean, what a joke.
It's disgusting.
It's madness. It's totally disgusting. It's just as anti-human as the transhumanist agenda.
Yeah,
it's anti-nature, but you know, the transhumanist agenda, a lot of people, you know, are pointing out how anti-human it is, but what we're really facing is more than anti-human. It's really anti-life.
Like, I mean,
all life.
Yeah. I mentioned
this is an effort. Yeah.
I mentioned in the beginning of our last episode, I know, you may not agree, but I think it's demonic. Like, I think there's like demonic evil forces behind all this that are really pushing this forward. And just, again, the blatant contradictions going back to Bill Gates, Reid Hoffman, Zuckerberg, and their Cobalt initiative. Like, we have a testing ground here in the United States. It's called the state of California for all these hypocritical and contradictory policies. We've already seen what happens when they phase out reliable nuclear and natural gas in their state in favor of wind and solar. And just 2 weeks ago, the state of California was begging its citizens not to charge their electric vehicles. And so if you play that forward and this green transition is successful, like, we're digging up all this cobalt and all this lithium for this EV revolution. But if we have a transition to these quote unquote green sustainable energy systems alongside that, like, you're not even going to be able to charge your electric vehicle.
Yeah. So I would make a distinction really quick. I don't think it's even just the green, I think it's how they have done the green energy transition as opposed to the technology of the green energy itself. So they have intentionally set it up in a way where they're not prepared to afford people the same standard of living they have now with the amount of renewables available. And that's intentional. That's intentional because they're trying to reduce the standard of living. The electrical vehicle revolution is not to enable renewable powered driving patterns as they exist now in the United States. It's to enable an Uber system for smart cities only. Yeah, it's not to enable like cross interstate or cross, you know, across the nation road trips or anything like that. Forget about it. With the EV stuff, it's going to be way shorter trips, and that's by design. And here's the thing: when you changing how energy works, you know, this I think again ties into the depopulation agenda. If you're able to restrict how much energy a person can consume, you're restricting how much economic activity they can engage in, and you're restricting how big their family can be.
Yeah.
And that's why it's happening this way. People are writing it off as incompetence. It's not incompetence. It's the plan.
I mean, that's been a big discussion on this show too. I have a lot of people on, or it's just pure incompetence. These people think they're doing good.
Bullshit. It's not incompetence. They know exactly what they're doing. Yeah.
If you look at things like net zero policy, if you look at that, there is no way that that can work with the population that we have at the moment, running our lives as we do at the moment. One of two things have got to give. Either we live much smaller, much more confined lives, or there are just simply less of us. Because if you look, for example, at things like cobalt, currently there is no evidence at all that there is sufficient cobalt on this earth to power even something like China's car use. That there isn't any evidence that cobalt actually exists. So the idea that we can all driving around in electric cars is utter nonsense. It's not true. So with current technology, of course, I mean, if there's some sort of technological leap forward that comes forward, but then, you know, who knows? Why would we imagine that that's the case? Based on current energy usage and based on current technology and based on the availability of resources, it is fair to say that what the sustainable agenda means is a massive reduction, as Whitney says, in energy use by us. Well, there's only two parts of that equation, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah. It's...
And then, it can't be incompetence. I mean, so much has been written off in incompetence in world history. Take like 9/11, for example. You know, written off as just pure incompetent and all this other stuff.
Hey, I mean, too soon. We just had the 21st anniversary earlier this week. We can't talk about that right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. 21 years too soon, I guess. My bad. So, but I mean, it's constantly used as, you know, same with COVID-19, written off as incompetence. The lockdowns, the toll of the lockdowns, they knew, everyone knew, well, except the people, you know, a lot of the people in the public, but there were critics and skeptics from the very beginning who were sidelined and ignored, and now they're backpedaling. But I mean, it was known what it was going to do then.
Yeah,
right?
And then you had the vaccine rollout, which is becoming glaringly obvious was probably a bad idea.
So when you're just saying they're incompetent, you're absolving them of any sort of criminal intention. Yeah. So you're just saying, okay, the world is run by idiots. And I would say, no, the world is run by professional criminals.
Yeah.
I wrote 900-page book about why that is so. And I think I make a pretty good case for that. So if you think it's all by incompetence at this point, how come everything's so coordinated between these guys with these policy agendas if it's all just by chance incompetence?
Yeah, you know? I tend to lean towards it's very nefarious and calculated. And
well, the more you look at it, and the more you look at these people, they're not stupid. They think you're stupid.
Yes.
If you look at the public health response to COVID-19, and I've looked at it particularly, obviously, from a UK perspective. If you look at what the government did, every single one of their policy responses increased the mortality risk, every single one. So if it was incompetence, you would imagine that a couple of their policy initiatives would have improved or reduced the mortality risk. None of them did, not one. Every single one increased the risk. So that seems to me like a concerted effort to increase the mortality risk. That is what they've done. So, for example, the UK government told the NHS to abandon what it called its NHS standards framework. Well, that meant that the NHS could discharge people without assessing first whether or not they've got an ongoing care need. So that increases the mortality risk. They then ordered the NHS to discharge every single patient that wasn't basically critically ill. That increased the mortality risk. They then sent them to care homes where they withdrew primary health care support. That increased the mortality risk. It's every single policy decision, one after another. They introduced midazolam into the care homes that GPs were prescribing without seeing patients because they couldn't go to the care homes. That increased the mortality risk. They gave midazolam to elderly, vulnerable people who they hadn't even assessed what their pressing health condition was. That increased their mortality risk. It's not unreasonable to say, and I'm more and more coming to the conclusion, that what we saw specifically in the UK, but I think everywhere, was a cull of the most vulnerable, a deliberate cull to give... Not only just, and I don't know whether it was necessarily purposefully to cull people, but I think it was to, obviously that creates the impression of a dangerous pandemic, if you possibly can. So you need people to die. So what we're going to do is systematically roll out policies that will induce people to die. That is what happened, in my view.
Here's another example of incompetence. Jeffrey Epstein's quote-unquote suicide, and the fact that the guards were asleep, the cameras didn't work, and all this other stuff that happened to enable his quote-unquote suicide, where per the official story in his like suicide risk, you know, paper-thin bed sheets, he hung himself from something that was shorter than his own standing height. So he had to curl up in the fetal position and dangle himself from something that was paper thin. Yeah. So that's the official narrative, and the guards being asleep, the cameras not working, all written off as incompetence. Okay. Yeah. So if you think Jeffrey Epstein killed himself, then you can't really buy the incompetence argument for these people. You know what I mean? And I think that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's a pretty big meme at this point. So, well, you know, there's no shortage of examples, to say the very least. And the more you actually bother to objectively look into this stuff, it's very hard to write it off all as incompetence, especially things like, you know, in economics and finance. Economic crises, pretty much every economic crisis of the past several decades has been a wealth transfer to the same people over and over again. Is that incompetence? Or that's a hell of a coincidence, isn't it?
That's happening right now as we speak. As well.
Sure, COVID was another wealth transfer. Policies specifically designed to enrich who? You mean you look at the Federal Reserve's policies, a good example would be the work of John Titus at Best Evidence over on YouTube. I mean, he's pretty much shown that the money from the Fed, who'd it go to? Checking accounts of the ultra rich, basically. Yeah. Check out his last videos. I mean, it's mental.
Whitney, we've discussed this many times on this show, but like, what the hell is it going to take to wake people up to actually begin fighting back against this utter evil that exists? Because it's only like they're only getting more emboldened, it seems, with these SDGs and
so
commoditization of emotions.
First thing, don't be afraid of these people, because if you're afraid of them, they have power over you. I think that is like a good starting point. Another good starting point is to start dismantling all this fairy tale stuff we're being told about what's happening and the solutions we're being offered right now. That's why Ian and I are doing this series. We think this stuff is really important and is very undercovered. I don't really know anyone doing deep dives on the SDGs right now, except for us. Or financialization of nature, except for Corey Morningstar, who doesn't publish very frequently and should be much better known than she is. But there's very few people working in this space. And this is an agenda with a lot of more money behind it than most other agendas at this point, to transform every aspect of our lives. Why aren't more people talking about it and looking into it? And so part of this is tied up with taking responsibility for ourselves. We have to know what these solutions, quote unquote solutions, are that they're foisting upon us really are. We have to take the time to educate ourselves about what's really going on here. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of different things we can do, too, in terms of getting off of the digital, you know, control grid as much as possible. CBDC should be a red line that no one listening to this podcast or watching it should cross. As soon as you start participating in the CBDC system, you have given yourselves over to it, because you're a slave to convenience. You have to get off it. You can't be part of that system.
Yeah. Do you guys have any hope that what they're trying to do is just getting too heavy and it's going to collapse in and of itself, because it's just they're going for way too much, way too fast? Like, I think COVID and the response to COVID and the vaccine rollout was way too much, way too fast. And I think that has a bunch of people startled, like, wait, what the fuck did we just do?
Unfortunately, I think we're now at the stage where they are at the destruction phase of, you know, they're at the point now where, what happens to us has become, if you look at the purpose of propaganda, the idea of convincing us to go along with all this stuff, obviously they care about what we think, but they're at the point now where they are creating circumstances. And I would suggest that the sanction response to the Ukraine war is a classic example of that, where they are creating circumstances which are in and of themselves going to have such a massive impact on everyone's lives that people are going to be, regardless of the propaganda, people are going to be so embroiled in just trying to make it through the next day that they're not going to have time to think about challenging this agenda. And if the government tells them that this is all Putin's fault, whether it is or whether it not, even whether they believe it or whether they don't, they're not going to care because they're going to be too busy thinking about how they're going to put food on the table. So that is the level at which we're at now. And I think, you know, this is why the solutions are not going to come from, in my view, the solutions are not going to come from us, one, continuing to listen to them. If we continue to listen to them and continue to do as we are told, then that can only lead us one way, and that is towards basically the evisceration of our societies. So what we need to do is start thinking about each other and start thinking about what we can affect now in our local communities. How can we, if you've got no health service in your town, if you can't see a doctor's appointment, if you can't get a doctor's appointment, if you can't do any of those crucial essential services that are being taken away from us every day, then what is the point of appealing to the people that are taking them away? There's no point in doing that. What we have to do is work together to replace those services. So we need to, and that's already starting to happen, thankfully, there's an organisation in the UK that are looking at building, it is going to be a private system. It will have to be a private system, and people will have to contribute at a private level. But we need to start taking responsibility for those essential things, because the government that we elect is serving the global, what I would call the parasite class. They are serving the bankers. They're not serving us anymore. So the way that we are going to be able to fight this is to take increasing responsibility for everything around us. We have to take that responsibility. And as increasingly as we do take responsibility, I mean, we were talking just now about whether it's incompetence or whether it's planned. It doesn't really matter, does it, whether it's incompetence or whether it's planned? Because if it's incompetence, what's the point of them? And if it's planned, who would listen to them? So we need to start taking responsibility for everything. You know, our food, where our water sources, our health services, we need to run them.
Taking the power back starts with yourself and your family and goes from there.
Yeah.
It goes from the local level up. And that's what we have to do. For too long, we've been waiting. I think, especially in the West, well, really most of the world, we've been psychologically conditioned to wait for a political savior to come fix everything. Decades and decades in the making. And there's a bunch of people now in the U.S. that see this stuff coming, and they're like, okay, Trump 2024. No way, dude. We don't, you know.
You guys remember Operation Warp Speed? Like,
We don't have, no, we cannot wait for that person. And even one person coming in, they're not going to let that person get to, you know, number 10 or the White House or whatever. It's not going to happen. Yeah. No. That political savior has to be us. We have, you know, a lot of people are failing to realize, you know, it also happens with like the debate about, is the multipolar world order a good thing? People see Russia and China as the good guys, or they're the heads of their government, Xi and Putin, as good guys, and the West is evil and stuff like that, or the reverse of that is also true. Okay, so no, the good guys are just the regular people. This is an us versus them thing, and the them are the 0.001% that are doing all the stuff we've been talking about today. Yeah. So if you want to get on the side of the good guys, that's building a parallel system with your neighbor. It's not going to the ballot box and voting for some dude who clawed his way to the top of some deeply corrupt political party. Yeah.
Completely agree. I mean,
yeah,
I know you know this, Whitney. Yeah. And I'm not sure what your thoughts on Bitcoin are, but that's why I'm focused on Bitcoin particularly, because it allows us to create this parallel monetary system and financial system that's being erected on top of it. And we have things here in the States that are beginning to pop up, which are very positive to see, like the Beef Initiative, where there's a real movement that's beginning to grow, where, you know, people are getting encouraged to go meet their rancher directly and buy directly from their rancher instead of depending on the large slaughtering warehouses here in the United States. And no, I completely agree. But that's the one thing I worry about, like how complacent, dumbed down, fat, and happy have people been lulled over the course of the last few decades.
That's the big question, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think currency is going to be... Oh, sorry, go ahead, Ian.
No, I was just going to say, I think it's really important that we accept that we need to rid ourselves of our obsession with convenience and comfort.
Totally.
Because that sort of quality of life, that often erodes our quality of life. We end up sitting on the sofa watching somebody skate around on an ice rink, thinking that that's, you know, a quality of life. That isn't. The quality of life, I would suggest, comes from the quality of our relationships with each other and the things that we do that we get for a sense of fulfillment out of, a sense of achievement. And that's, we come from that by overcoming adversity, not by sitting around being bored and looking for the next big thing or getting a better phone. I mean, what is all this stuff? Why are we obsessed with all this stuff? We would be, I think, have a better quality of life if we, as Whitney was saying, focus on our local community and focus on each other and start living more independent lives. But that won't be easy. Not only will it not be easy, there will be attempts. If we do that at a sufficient scale, there will be attempts probably by our governments to stop us doing it. So we have to face up to the reality that in order to actually resist this, if we are serious about resisting this, then we are going to have to overcome and persevere. That is the way that we can change things.
And we can, because their systems are based around us being so much slaves to convenience that they think they can lead us anywhere. If we stop using a lot of their systems, they can't, there's nothing they can do, especially like things like the smartphone and stuff, right? So I think what people should be focusing on, and particularly people that, you know, are financially wise, like a lot of people that listen to you, Marty, start getting your local community comfortable, if not already utilizing the idea of utilizing a different currency, a local currency. And it can be anything. You want to start with Bitcoin, cool, but they could try and pull the plug on Bitcoin, illegalize Bitcoin, make it illegal to do whatever. I mean, we're sort of seeing executive orders in the US, right, with Biden trying to target people with crypto and stuff, including Bitcoin and all of that. So who knows how that's going to pan out? Yeah. But I mean, you can use anything really as a currency, and humans have done it for a long time, and it doesn't have to be Fed bucks. Yeah.
Well,
anything you can do
in the ideal world
to not be on the CBDC.
Well, that's why, I mean, I think it's very prescient that we're having this conversation on the day that Ethereum transitioned to Ethereum 2.0, where all the biggest regulated exchanges control the validation of that blockchain. I think Bitcoin is the silver bullet on the currency side, but it is going to take a concerted effort by Bitcoiners, myself included, to ensure that it is sufficiently robust to withstand the attacks that are undoubtedly going to come from the state. They've already started, like you mentioned. That's why I'm very focused outside of this show.
You got to be prepared for everything, though, is my point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. I know that they're already, aren't they, using sustainability as a way to Bitcoin.
Well, that's...
because of the energy usage in mining it. So, you know, obviously you can't have it because of that.
Yeah, fuck them, though. I'm going to go find as many natural gas wells as I can.
Really quick, I'm probably going to have to run soon because my little people are home and antsy for mom. You and Ian, feel free to take it from here. But if you want to follow any of my stuff or read Ian's and my new articles and series, check out unlimitedhangout.com. Sign up for the newsletter, unlimitedhangout.com/newsletter. Thanks.
And go donate.
I'll let you guys take
go
it
donate
here.
Via Bitcoin. You can donate on Unlimited Hangout.
You can. Whitney. Thanks.
Whitney, thank you.
All right. Take care.
Cheerio. Bye.
See ya.
I'm interested. I mean, I don't know much about cryptocurrency, but I mean, as far as I'm slightly invested in it a little bit because it seemed like a good idea. But I'm interested in the technology of it in terms of, and I think more than perhaps the coins themselves, it's the technology that is so promising, that, you know, the blockchain technology. Because as I understand it, you know, if you have this, it's essentially egalitarian, isn't it? If you've got these anonymous nodes that are performing the checksums that enable the transactions to be verified, that is essentially egalitarian. But I think that the danger comes that you can flip that technology, you can reverse that technology if something like central bank digital currency, which is also based on the blockchain, but is the intention is to control the nodes. So you control the nodes. So then it becomes basically a financial tracking system.
Oh yeah, and that's why, I mean, here on this show and everything I do professionally, whether it be mining Bitcoin or I work for a venture fund too, and we invest in Bitcoin businesses, it's solely focused on Bitcoin because they're all the other coins and applications of blockchain technology have completely been corrupted by central authorities and central entities. And I would stress that I know everybody, there's a big meme, blockchain, not Bitcoin, blockchain's the innovation, but it really is Bitcoin that is the innovation. It goes back to the energy use, which is funny that the governments of the world are attacking Bitcoin because of how much energy it uses. I think that's actually a signal that Bitcoin is actually a threat to their power, because what Bitcoin does is it leverages the fact that energy use is abundant and widely dispersed globally, and you can contribute to the ledger by tapping into these stranded energy sources that are extremely hard to find and physically shut down. And that's why I think we're beginning to see a large concerted effort by governments and regulators to highlight Bitcoin's energy use, because at the end of the day, that is where their power is going to be receded from, is by building the system, by leveraging all these stranded energy sources. And that's another thing, talking about like messaging, how do we get through this? I think just taking a step back from Bitcoin specifically, but like going back to energy, energy is life. Like we've described throughout this podcast, we would not be where we are today. I would not be able to speak into this microphone, look at you on this monitor, and then after this is recorded, distribute it and syndicate it out globally to the world without significant energy use. And that's like another sort of theme on the narrative front that I've been very focused on here at this show, is just really trying to highlight to people that the climate, I personally don't believe we're in a climate crisis. I think we're going to be fine. I think climate has changed drastically throughout Earth's history, and this is nothing compared to drastic changes that have happened in the past. And even if there is a climate crisis, which I don't think there is, humans are the most adaptable species that have ever existed on this planet. We will be fine. And it's really trying to highlight that they're trying to control us by controlling the energy. Again, energy is life. It's the basis from which our society is built upon, and they're going after that. And so it's just trying to begin to incept into the public that energy is good. We're not in a climate crisis, and you're being misled by these Pied Pipers.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that's you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of, and then going to the article that Winnie and I have just written, that is the key fact of it. The fact that it's, whether or not you accept, I agree with you, I don't accept the climate, so-called climate emergency either, but it doesn't matter, because that's not what it's about. What it's about is managing our every aspect of our lives, particularly energy and food and our health. I mean, those are the things that they want to have. They're introducing global financial governance into every human activity, because they intend to both make profit from it, but also they can reverse that polarity and control it through the same mechanism. So, for example, when we were looking at the health impacts of sustainable development goals, I thought I would see what the health impact of this UHC 2030, which is SDG 3, introducing a global health, I can't remember what they call it, the Global Health Initiative or whatever they term it. But The idea is that I thought I would look at the impact that has already had on the on developing countries. So I thought I'll pick a country at random in Africa and see what the impact is. And I just happened to pick Uganda. I just picked Uganda just to start with, just to see what the impact was. What I discovered in about what that impact was in Uganda was enough to write a whole article. what they've done in Uganda through the COVID, through the what I would call the pseudo pandemic, through that, is they restructured Ugandan debt, so their debt obligation. Then they used Ugandan debt obligations to buy in COVID mitigation measures, which meant that they suspended a lot of their public health programs on things like malaria. Now, bearing in mind that in Uganda, they didn't have what you could call a pandemic. Deaths per million of population in Uganda from COVID-19 was 74. In the US, they were nearly 3,200. So we're talking about a completely different thing. They didn't have that pandemic. But nonetheless, they convinced Uganda to go down the COVID mitigation measures at the expense of things like malaria, which killed four times more people than COVID did in Uganda. So their malaria programs were laid to one side. Their treatment, their public health system, which actually in Uganda was pretty good. It was a mixed health economy, a public-private health economy in Uganda. But actually in African, as African developing nations go, their public health system wasn't bad. That was more or less crashed. It almost completely crashed. They didn't have medication for people that were on cancer cancer treatments, all their screening, that collapsed. People couldn't get the medication that they needed. Hospitals shut down. It was just a total disaster. And they then sold them vaccines at three times the market rate that they sold them in Europe. So AstraZeneca was selling, in Europe, they were selling their jab, which ended up not being taken up so much in Europe because it was giving people blood clots. They sold them at $2.18 per unit. But that's how much it cost AstraZeneca, or that's how much AstraZeneca charged in Europe. Uganda, it was $7. So they sold 18 million of these shots at $7 each, at a markup of 300%.
$125 million in revenue, or euro, whatever.
And they paid for that, and the Ugandans had to pay for that through debt restructuring. So it is a scam, it's
epic proportions.
So that was just the first country in Africa that I looked at. I just picked that at random, and that's what I found.
Holy shit. We need people to wake up and get angry, get even.
Yeah.
It's
yeah. Yeah, I mean, we definitely need people to do that.
Well, Ian, I thank you for the work that you're doing, have done. I mean, you want to plug the book Pseudo Pandemic?
So I write at my own blog website, which is iandavis.com. It's IAIN davis.com, spelt the English way. I also write for and work for UK Column. I'm fortunate that I have quite a lot of my work syndicated with other people. Very lucky to be able to work with Whitney Webb at Unlimited Hangout. Off Guardian and people like that quite often reshare my work. I'm an author as well. I've written two books, A Dangerous Ideology, and my latest book, which I wrote in 2021, was Pseudo Pandemic. Pseudo Pandemic basically is about the information that was available during the pandemic, because other publicly available, otherwise I wouldn't have been able to write about it because I wouldn't have known about it. That people weren't told. So everything that I could catalogue, I just started cataloguing, really, all the information that that people were not made aware of during what I've termed the pseudo-pandemic. And to understand why I termed it the pseudo-pandemic, you can get my book on my website. It's freely available as a PDF download. And I only charge really if somebody wants a hard copy, because obviously there's a printing cost for the hard copy. But the idea of the global public-private partnership, which is something I know a lot of people have fortunately picked up and are starting to talk about, I really owe that as well to an excellent researcher in the UK, a guy called Richard D. Hall, who he has his own site, richplanet.net. He pulled out the global governance network that I plotted in my book. He made an initial graph out of that, an initial diagram out of that. And then together we worked together to create what became, you know, a lot of people spoke about in terms of the global public-private partnership. So, and that is a model which I hope people can look at. And if they read the book, I can hope that they'll come to appreciate why I talk about the flow of policy rather than a global government. I think we're somewhere away from that yet, but that is certainly where we're heading.
Yeah, there's this ephemeral governance structure driven by these agendas. And in terms of the series that you and Whitney are working on, what can we expect moving forward? When's the next piece going to drop? What are you guys going to be covering?
Yeah, well, we're hoping to go through all the SDGs. So there's 17 of them. So, you know, we've already more or less, I think the 17th is probably the one that sets the scene, because that's about the multi-stakeholder partnership and it's kind of the framework, the developmental framework for all the others. So we're going to look at all of them. And as we said, you know, that there's an SDG for pretty much everything. So we've got another 16 to write about. But I mean, whether we'll write about each and every one, I don't know. But we're certainly hoping to sort of be putting the articles out, you know, every couple of weeks or so that people can follow the series and hopefully expose. And this is what really matters, that we can expose what is actually behind this agenda, because it isn't anything like what most people imagine it to be. And it's designed that way. That one of the things that we mentioned in the first article was what we called untangling the word salad, because it's sold to us with all this fluffy rhetoric about inclusivity and resilience and sustainability and all these things that sound like wonderful ideas, but dig beneath it and those things quickly evaporate. And what we're left with is hard-nosed control mechanisms. That's what this is about.
Well, Ian, I want to thank you for your work. It's extremely important. I'm happy that we were able to sit down and discuss all this today. I hope anybody listening out there, please share this episode. We need to get these messages out there. We need people to wake up and understand that there is a massive power grab. And at the end of the day, especially if you have children, like I've got two young sons, and just thinking that there is this nefarious cabal of the 0.001% of people out there who just so happened to come up time and time again throughout the decades as working together to produce bad outcomes. Just to think that they're out there actively trying to push my sons into some subjugated reality is infuriating. And if you're out there with children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, whatever it may be, I hope you have a fire lit up in your body as well, because this shit's serious. And luckily, we have people like Ian and Whitney out there on the front lines trying to wake us all up. So very happy that we were able to do this, Ian. Hopefully, we can do it again as you guys continue through the series. Maybe we'll wait one or two more articles in the series and catch up on what you guys covered in those, and we can continue this conversation.
No, I really appreciate it, Marty. Thank you very much. It's very nice to meet you. And I would also say that definitely, you know, cryptocurrencies and alternative ways of payment are also really important. We are gonna need those kinds of solutions. So thank you for what you're doing as well.
Hey, we're all in this together. Let's
absolutely
Let's go forth and light a fire under everybody's ass. It's time to take control, people, before you get controlled.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. That's all we got. Peace and love, freaks.